This is Talking to America. I'm your host, Aaron Zellman. Our special guest today is David T. Hardy, attorney at law. David is the producer and director of a new documentary that will help all of us in helping others understand the true meaning of the Second Amendment. The name of the documentary is In Search of the Second Amendment. David, welcome to Talking to America.
Yeah, thank you, Aaron. Glad to be here.
Tell us a little bit about you and tell us where people can contact you to order the film.
Well, I'm an attorney. I'm practicing for 30 years. I started writing on the Second Amendment actually while I was still in law school. I published my first article back in 1974. I think it played a role in the revival of the Second Amendment in academic thought. It was probably the first what you would call modern Second Amendment article. I've kept at it for 32 years since, publishing and studying it as much as I could. The documentary, if someone wants to order it, the best bet is the website, which is www.secondamendmentdocumentary.com, Second Amendment all being spelled out rather than numerals. Or you can just Google Second Amendment documentary and you'll come right to it either way. It's, as far as I can see, the first real documentary on the Second Amendment, the specific focus on the history of the American right to arms as opposed to, you know, the value of the right to arms and similar concepts.
Well, I know that after I watched, I was really enthusiastic about it because, as I had mentioned to you, I think you've taken just hundreds of years of knowledge and you've condensed it into less than 2 hours. You've made it real easy for people to explain the history and the value and the necessity for an armed citizenry, which I think is what the Second Amendment is all about.
Yep. I tried to cover every aspect of the amendment from the, you know, the political angle, which, you know, the deterrence of tyranny, the prevention of genocide, which, of course, you and JPFO have explored more extensively, and also the concept that when the framers wrote of preventing oppression, they didn't just have public oppression in mind, governmental oppression, they also had in mind the concept of private oppression by criminality and how important it is with self-defense, the 2.5 million self-defense uses per year.
Well, why don't we break this discussion down into two main parts? Let's deal with things that people probably don't know that they should know that you tell them about, and then let's also deal with how people can use your film to help win the battle.
What people don't know that they would learn from this film, there are quite a few concepts, but I'd say one right off the top would be that the top constitutional law scholars in the United States maintain that there are two constitutional guarantees of the right to arms. Obviously, we have the Second Amendment, but there's also the 14th Amendment, which was ratified after the Civil War, 1868, and had a clause in there forbidding states to abridge the privileges and immunities of U.S. citizenship. And if you go back into the congressional debates, the main reason for that clause that keeps coming up time after time is in the states of the former Confederacy, they were disarming black Civil War veterans who'd gone home with their muskets in order to render them vulnerable to Klan attack. And the governments were doing this. And I've got in there quotations from the congressional record that are just beautiful, where one guy is saying that reads off one of the laws that made it illegal for black Americans to own arms. They actually had them, and says that last time I checked the Constitution, there was something in it called the Second Amendment, and until the state learns to respect the Bill of Rights and their local gun laws, I'm going to vote against its readmission to the Union. So there's quite stunning evidence that in 1868, the framers of the 14th Amendment also meant to protect the right to arms as they understood it at the time, and moreover that this was an intensely personal right. One of our law professors, one of the biggest names in the field of constitutional law, makes that point, that when you talk about the Second Amendment, you're talking about right to keep and bear arms, but it's in a political context. The militia will deter any federal tyranny. When you talk about the right to arms in 1868 under the 14th Amendment, it's very personal. It's not going to do. It's not you're going to deter political tyranny. It's you're going to fight off an invader at your front door and protect your house and your family. So to his mind, that makes it an even more personal, singular defensive right than it was in the first place. I doubt there are probably but a couple of dozen people in the country who know that. And I've got, like I say, the biggest men in American constitutional law explaining that that's the case.
Well, now thousands and thousands of people will know it.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks to you.
I'm hoping. And as far as how you can use it, I designed this not to preach to the choir. Let's face it, we've got plenty of stuff out there which really just preaches the choir. If you already believe in your gun rights, this will make you believe even more in your gun rights. It'll tell you you're correct. I designed this to go beyond that. First, if you are a gun activist, you'll be well armed with intellectual information, the ammunition that you can use at the end of watching the movie. But also I intended to make it such that is I could come as close as possible to guaranteeing making a convert out of anybody else you show it to. I mean, anyone who watches it will come away with the right to keep and bear arms is probably our most ancient right, dating back over 1,000 years in English law. It was well recognized by the framers and intended to be a personal right. The National Guard has nothing to do with it. It's not even the militia. It wasn't legally intended to be the militia. Congress, when they set it up, designed it as a component of the Army. And finally, that the right to keep and bear arms is enormously important, both on a national basis and an international basis. And guns are used far more often to defend against criminals than used by criminals. So I intended, and it will all be related with, here are the documents, while an expert explains them to you. These are not just talking heads. These are some of the top professors of constitutional law in the country. I want a viewer who is not, you know, already a member of the Brady campaign, but someone who is in the middle, you know, knows about the right to keep and bear arms, but doesn't particularly care, to come away from this believing strongly in the right to arms and understanding why we activists view it as such an important thing. I wrote this to make converts.
From what I saw of it, I think there's no doubt that you've made it easy for gun owners to go out and talk to other people and show the film and accomplish the goal that you're trying to achieve.
Mm-hmm. And I've got segments in there. I mean, if you're talking about two portions of the population where we haven't made a great penetration, as it were, you would probably be talking about urban African Americans and women. And so I structured the entire 14th Amendment end to speak, and a civil rights struggle. I have a couple of civil rights workers in there who talk about how they owned guns and defended themselves against Klan attack with them, and how basically all civil rights workers, or almost all, were armed. It just never made the papers. They weren't stupid. They knew people were trying to kill them. So I've got a drive in there that would appeal to Black Americans. The 14th Amendment is part of their history, very much their particular contribution to the right to arms and the concept of American liberty, and a pitch toward women, because I have women speakers, Carol Bamberry, Sandy Frohman, and some others, carrying much of the self-defense end of the film.
What would you suggest that people in the African-American community do, who believe as we do in the right to keep and bear arms, the right to defend one's life, what would you suggest they do to reach out to the Jesse Jackson crowd and the Al Sharpens and the NAACP who don't believe in gun ownership?
I'm tempted to say show them this film, but that might be a bit self-serving. I think the argument...
A good first step, as long as they can get somebody to sit down and watch, but yeah. Beyond showing your film, are there any suggestions? Because whatever
sure.
You suggest probably is also going to be useful for people like me in the Jewish community mm-hmm. who are trying to reach the so-called leadership with the truth.
Yep. I would say the argument to be made there to the Jesse Jacksons, etc., is that, hey, the right to keep and bear arms is our right. I mean, the 14th Amendment was all built around laws that disarm specifically Black Americans and Union veterans. It was designed to keep them in their place and keep them vulnerable to a violent attack. The Civil Rights Movement was based largely upon people who were armed and therefore couldn't be snuffed out by the Klan at their leisure, as happened to some of them who made the mistake of not going armed. And even today, who most needs the right to defend against criminal attack? And the answer is, urban area African-Americans disproportionately. That's the group that is looking at the worst threat of criminal attack. And here's this, like I say, 2.5 million defensive uses per year.
Where does that number come from again?
I filmed Professor Gary Kleck, professor of criminology, Florida State University, and he's done the biggest surveys on defensive gun use that have ever been undertaken. I think he surveyed 5,000 people, whereas for most polls on who's going to win the presidency, you stop at about 1,200. Well, he got 5,000. And extrapolating from their answers, he said the conclusion was that Americans use guns defensively about 2.5 million times a year. He also said that about 400,000 of those people projected would say, if you asked them, that they felt their defensive gun use preserved a life, either their own or someone else's. He goes on to point out, all you can know in a survey is what a person tells you. But suppose that of those 400,000 who would say it, 90% were wrong. That's still 40,000 lives saved, which is more than were taken by criminal use. So the odds are that in terms of protecting against crime versus committing crime, guns at least break even and probably come out on top in terms of saving more lives than are taken.
Well, they certainly would have been useful during World War II in Europe.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Some people don't quite understand that yet, but had people had firearms and were willing to use them, I think there'd be more dead Nazis than were alive Nazis. There's a lot of information here, and I hope that people will buy the video because there's more than we can really cover in 30 minutes. But let's spend some time talking about what people can do with this and what you'd recommend and what kind of, a game plan people can put together to utilize all the knowledge that you've put together.
Well, I think Professor Glenn Reynolds, who's in the film actually, has published a book called Army of Davids, the idea that modern technology enables us to organize spontaneously without an organizational pattern behind us, without the mass media supporting us. You can get thousands of people to do something without having a formal structure. And I think with this DVD, every gun owner can essentially become a one-person PR firm for the Second Amendment. They can show it to people. In fact, I put up on the website a license that after April 1st of the coming year, they can show it on cable TV for free. So go to your community, start showing it. Show it to your friends. Show it to your kids so they know the history of the right to arms and why it's important. See if their school will let you show it. I mean, essentially, every one of us can become a PR firm.
What would you suggest, though, and a little more specifically, that people can do, let's say, in their own family, their own community, with their coworkers? What kind of activities, aside from simply showing it, can they undertake to encourage others to become very enthusiastic about the right to keep and bear arms?
I think just talking to them, explaining the importance. If you're in an area where you can get CCW permits, suggest to those who might need the most protection, in particular ladies in the office, that you might want to look into this.
You mentioned CCW permits, concealed carry permits. From a JPFO perspective, concealed carry permits are immoral. I mean by that, we all have a God-given right to defend our life. So why do we have to pay the state for a revocable privilege that then tells us where we can carry a firearm to defend our life? Do you have any comments about what kind of mindset I think CCW owners should start developing so that we can eliminate these laws and fully enjoy a God-given right?
Well, I think the mindset you'd start out with is obviously they've had an extremely good record in terms of CCW holders not getting in trouble except over technical points. So your next step would be to try to extrapolate that to gun ownership in general, responsible gun owners in general. That would there be a problem with them carrying? Well, it's sort of hard to articulate it. I mean, how many, obviously you have to ask yourself, how many people who are bent upon committing a serious crime are going to be worried about a misdemeanor citation for carrying concealed? So presumably, I suspect the answer is pretty close to zero. So what's the good of it? I think you might want to develop the sort of mindset that even though I got this permit, I really would have liked to get it, you know, to have my rights without having to get the permit, and therefore maybe that's the next step.
Well, I think that is. I think that the governed, you know, give our consent to the government, and I think it's time to withdraw our consent.
Well, we've seen some movement here in Arizona toward moving slowly in that direction. Of course, Arizona was always open carry, no CCW at all, but you could carry openly anywhere you wanted. Then we went with an optional CCW system, and now they're starting to pare back the requirements. So we may eventually get there. I think the first one was they cut out the requirement for taking 4 hours retraining every 3 years. And then I think they cut down on the number of hours. And so you may eventually get there just step by step.
Well, with due pressure from people who have something to offer the country and be able to tell the government that they're wrong, yeah, I think maybe in due time.
Mm-hmm.
But sooner better than later. It took you many years to put this film together.
Mm-hmm.
And I think for those of us who make films, I guess a question from my perspective is, what was the most difficult thing you had to deal with?
Well, it took almost exactly 4 years. I started filming in January 2003, and I trust you'll understand where I'm coming from when I say the biggest problem was getting up enough money to do it. You know, with any documentary of this type, and I'm sure with yours, you know, you work, you get something done, and then you have to go back. There's no budget to do the rest of it, so you have to go back and try and scare up some money to do that. Do one more thing, and then go back and look for it. I'll tell you the truth, Aaron. I suspect that both of us, as working on documentaries, come to appreciate what it was like to be the captain of a mercenary army in the medieval period. I mean, basically, the troops need to be fed, and so for every day you spend fighting, you'll spend 6 months trying to, keep things together.
That's pretty much it. That's a good way to put it. When you were traveling around the country and doing the documentary film, did you have any problems with people who didn't want to talk or who were reluctant to be interviewed?
Only one who I won't mention. It was just seemed like I could never set up the actual filming. And I don't know what was going on there. He may just have been camera shy.
Oh, all right. Then
the other problem with so often was that you would, you know, you fly in, get everything organized, and you're just praying that everything works out. And then you show up on the scene, and you've got problems like there's air conditioning noise, because I film most of this in their offices, and not in the studio. So you go in an office, and there's air conditioning noise. It's going to pick up on the tape clearly. So you wind up juggling the microphone to get rid of it. There is one section in there where in the film where I'm in Arlington National Cemetery, and they had to filter the audio so heavily that the voice sounds sort of ringing for about 15 seconds, sort of like you're speaking in an echoey room. That's a product of the audio filtering, because you can't move Arlington Cemetery, and it's only about 100 yards from a major highway, so there's terrific traffic noise and no way you'd ever do without it.
Let me ask you another question, a little getting back more to the Second Amendment. What future do you see in America for the Second Amendment, for an armed citizenry, for politicians, understanding the true meaning of the Second Amendment, its true intent?
I sort of write off politicians, but with regard to the rest of us...
That's a good point. Now, why should people write them off?
Because I think, for the most part, they don't care about the Constitution at all. I mean, they view that as just at best, an impediment, and which, of course, it is. It's meant to impede the legislature doing certain things. At the very most, maybe something, hey, the courts worry about that. So if it's unconstitutional, the courts strike it down. We don't have to worry. Never mind that we took an oath of office to support and defend the Constitution, just like a judge does.
No. Think they remember taking that oath?
No.
Okay.
I mean, I don't think they take it seriously at all. I doubt there are five people in Congress who seriously, must be Ron Paul and four others somewhere, who seriously regard that oath as morally binding in any sense. So I tend to cross them off. But the people, I think we've seen a resurgence. I think actually over the last 20 years, maybe 30, we're coming ahead. We're winning the fight. I mean, if you look at 1968, the Gun Control Act passes. It's pretty much, in fact, it passed twice. First, there was the omnibus bill, which mostly pertained only to pistols. Then a few months later, they come back with the Gun Control Act of 68, because that wasn't enough. They have to control rifles, too. They're on a roll. They're looking at maybe getting national registration. They didn't get that in 68, but they thought they had a good shot at it, and maybe they'd get it in a few years. National permit systems, everything. Look at it today. I don't think even, I mean, if you look at Brady and the other groups, they aren't even talking about that. What they're talking about is, oh, we just want this or that common sense thing, basically want to nibble away. Well, they're still nibbling, but at least they're not in a position where even they think they can take a big bite. It's changed.
What steps do you think that we could do as gun owners, 100 million of us, as I understand the number correctly, to eliminate gun control in America?
You'll have to talk the only language, well, one of the only languages a politician understands, and that is votes. If you don't eliminate this, I will not vote for you, period. I don't care if you cut taxes or increase taxes or anything else. But if you don't vote to take out these provisions of the gun law, I'm not going to vote for you, period. Politicians understand that language. They may not understand their oath of office, but they understand losing votes.
This raises a very interesting question from my perspective. Again, assuming there's about 100 million gun owners in America, and this is really a guess on your part, it's speculation, that this message of votes is something that we've not been able to get 100 million gun owners to agree on.
Well, yeah, I think even among gun owners, we're not all, even gun activists are not all single issue. And that's the problem. The politician figures he can peel off enough votes with other things to where that someone will vote his way because he did the right thing on Social Security or taxes or something. And so, okay, I lose a few votes because I haven't started eliminating gun control. Well, I can write them off. The question is how many of the voters really are genuinely willing to make this just, I don't care what else you do. If you don't back me on this, I won't back you, period. I mean, obviously, if 100 million voters did that, we'd have a complete turnaround in the country. I mean, at the next election, next election, they probably just learned their lesson. Election after that, they'd pretty much have to abolish whatever you wanted if you actually had 100 million voters acting in unison.
Do you think your documentary can help 100 million gun owners finally understand the Second Amendment in its entirety and what it's all about, so that we can get closer to the point of having millions and millions of more people are going to tell the politicians, do it my way or you're fired?
I sincerely hope so. I can't guarantee it, but at least they'll understand, you know, how the amendment got there and why we need it today.
Well, why don't we just review a little? What do you want gun owners to understand? And what do you suggest they do to help others understand, and especially the politicians?
What I'd like gun owners to understand is that the American right to arms is our oldest right, it's up there with jury trial, one of our two oldest rights, that it dates back over 1,000 years, and in fact was first written as a right recognized by Parliament over 2 centuries ago. I'd like them to realize that it was clearly intended by the framers as an individual right, that the National Guard had absolutely nothing to do with it. It's a personal right. It's your right and my right. And I'd like them to understand that it has current value today in terms of protection against tyranny, protection against genocide, and protection against criminals. Once they understand that, I think they really have a basis in the Second Amendment. What I'd like them to do is start to figure that we're going to retake this right. I mean, it's been chewed away at, and there are still groups trying to chew away at it. Essentially, it's our right, and we have to protect it for ourselves and for our kids.
Why don't you tell people again where they can order the documentary?
Oh, sure. Best bet is the webpage, www.secondamendmentdocumentary.com. That's second spelled out, not a numeral. I've also got some coupons if they want to send in on the website, but I haven't so far really had any other way of ordering. I'm just starting out here.
Now, you have another website. I mean, it's called Of Arms and the Law.
Yeah. The website address is armsandthelaw.com. I didn't put the of in front of it.
Okay. And it's a daily blog, and people can come there and sign up for your alerts.
Yeah. It's a blog devoted specifically to gun laws. So occasionally I go into gun things outside of gun laws and Second Amendment studies, but I try to stick as much as I can to legislation and constitutional points.
What other points would you like to raise?
I think that probably is about the areas that I was hoping to cover. Just that, as I say, this was 4 years of production based on 32 years of research, so it is pretty extensive.
Think you got it figured out by now?
Yeah, pretty much. there's still a few murky areas, but most of them are covered.
I think that's called politicians. But
yeah.
Well, David, I want to thank you very much for being a guest on Talking to America. I'm your host, Aaron Zellman. I'd like to remind all of you, if you don't defend your rights, don't complain when you lose them.
Opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of JPFO.org or its members. Talking to America is a production of JPFO.org.